We are here to talk about a chapter from the free and peer-reviewed textbook Orthopedia, available at www.orthopedia.com by Bernstein, Penny, and Vallette. You can't beat the price, and because it's peer-reviewed, you can trust the content.
It really is an amazing resource, and it's great that it's so accessible to everyone. Today, we're going to be diving into the world of those crucial cruciate ligaments, the ACL and the PCL.
Yeah, I think most people have heard of the ACL, especially those who follow sports. But can you give us a quick refresher on what they are and why they're so important for knee stability?
Okay, so imagine two really strong rope-like bands of tissue. They're deep inside your knee joint, and they connect your thigh bone, that's the femur, to your shin bone, the tibia. And these are your cruciate ligaments, and the name actually kind of gives away their arrangement. Cruciate comes from the Latin word for cross, so yeah, you guessed it, they crisscross inside your knee.
So like an X right in the middle of the knee, got it. But why are they so important? What makes them crucial for stability?
Well, think of them as your knee's internal brakes and guide rails, all in one. So the ACL, the anterior cruciate ligament, it prevents the shin bone from sliding too far forward in relation to the thigh bone. And then the PCL, the posterior cruciate ligament, it does the opposite, stopping the shin bone from sliding too far backward. So basically, without them, your knee would be like incredibly unstable. Walking, running, even just standing, super difficult.
Okay, I get the brakes analogy, but guide rails is interesting. What do you mean by that?
Right, yeah. So they're not just about like completely stopping movement. They're also kind of guiding the movement of the knee. They control the subtle rolling and gliding that happens when you bend and straighten your leg. Keeps everything in alignment, prevents those joint surfaces from grinding against each other.
Okay, so they're keeping things moving smoothly, not just stopping them from going too far. Now, we mentioned earlier that the ACL is injured more often than the PCL. Is there a reason for that, or is it just bad luck?
It's definitely more than bad luck. The ACL is just, for a few reasons, more vulnerable to injury. First, it's not as thick and strong as the PCL. Second, it's positioned in a way that makes it more susceptible to those twisting and pivoting forces, especially when the foot is planted. Like, picture a basketball player changing direction quickly. That sudden twisting force can be enough to overstretch and tear the ACL.
But isn't twisting a pretty natural movement for our knees? Why doesn't it always result in an ACL tear?
Yeah, good question. It all comes down to the magnitude and direction of the force, position of the foot, even individual anatomy. Sometimes a twist is fine, other times it's just too much. And then you add in things like fatigue, poor conditioning, and the risk just goes up even more.
So it's like a perfect storm of factors can lead to an ACL tear. What about the PCL? You said it's stronger. Does it ever get injured?
It does, but it usually takes a much more powerful force, like a direct blow to the front of the knee, the kind you might experience in a car accident. Think of your knee hitting the dashboard. That force can push the shin bone backwards and potentially tear the PCL.
Ouch, that sounds pretty intense. Is there anything else about the PCL that's different from the ACL? I think you mentioned something about healing potential earlier.
Yes, that's a key difference. The ACL, unfortunately, has very limited ability to heal itself. So once it's torn, surgery is usually required to restore stability. The PCL, on the other hand, has a slightly better chance of healing on its own, especially if the tear isn't complete. Might be because it has a better blood supply, which allows those healing cells to reach the injured area more easily.
Okay, makes sense. A better blood supply would definitely help. It's so fascinating how these two ligaments, even though they're so close together and both crucial for knee stability, can be so different.
It really is. And if anyone wants to delve deeper into this, remember, you can visit orthopedia.com. It's a free, peer-reviewed resource with a wealth of information.
Great reminder. I've always wondered about the position of the cruciate ligaments. Like, they're almost vertical inside the knee. Yeah. Wouldn't a more horizontal position, you know, make more sense for resisting those front-to-back movements we were talking about?
Yeah, you'd think so, right? But if they were horizontal, imagine trying to bend your knee. You wouldn't get very far. That nearly vertical orientation is actually a brilliant evolutionary compromise because it allows those ligaments to still provide stability, but also allows for a pretty wide range of motion. And that range of motion is essential for all those everyday activities, walking, running, climbing stairs, you name it.
So it's that trade-off, that balance between stability and mobility. Is there a good way to visualize how that works, how those ligaments, despite their orientation, still manage to control that front-to-back motion?
I like to imagine like a scaffold. You know the ones window washers use, hanging from two crossed ropes. So the scaffold is your shin bone, the ropes are your cruciate ligaments, and that point where they cross, that's your knee joint. So as the scaffold swings back and forth, those crossed ropes, they're guiding its movement, keeping it stable, preventing it from swinging wildly. That that's essentially what those cruciate ligaments are doing inside your knee.
Okay, that's a great analogy. I can totally picture it. So they're not just like simple restraints. They're actively guiding the movement. Speaking of movement, you mentioned that ligaments need some laxity to function properly. What does that mean and why is it important?
Well, ligaments, they aren't supposed to be completely rigid. They need a little bit of give, elasticity, to allow for all those natural gliding and rolling motions within the joint. If they were too tight, movement would be restricted, too loose, not enough stability. So it's all about finding that sweet spot, the balance between the two.
So it's like a perfectly tuned suspension system in a car. Too stiff, and it's a bumpy ride. Too loose, and the car feels all over the place. So we've got a good grasp on what these ligaments are, how they function, why they're so important. But what happens when things go wrong? Let's talk about those dreaded injuries, starting with the ACL. What are some of the most common ways it gets injured?
Well, as we mentioned before, the ACL is really susceptible to injury during those sudden twisting or pivoting movements, especially when the foot is planted. So picture this. You're playing soccer, plant your foot to change direction, and suddenly your knee buckles inward. That inward twist combined with all the force from your momentum can really overstretch and tear that ACL.
I've also heard it's not just the twisting, but something called internal rotation of the tibia that really ups the risk. What does that mean exactly?
Yeah, so that inward twist often involves internal rotation of the tibia, meaning the shin bone is rotating inward relative to the thigh bone, kind of like if you turn your foot inward while your knee is bent. And that rotation further stretches the ACL, making it even more vulnerable to tearing.
So it's the direction of that twist that matters, not just the twisting force itself. And I imagine the force from the body's momentum during all those crazy athletic maneuvers plays a role as well, right?
Absolutely. The faster you're moving, the greater the force is involved. Think of it like a car crash. The faster the car is going, the greater the potential for damage. And while it's less common, a direct blow to the knee, like a tackle in football, can also do it.
Okay, I'm starting to get why ACL tears are so common in athletes. Mm-hmm. So you're playing basketball, plant your foot, twist, and suddenly, POP. What is that popping sound, and what does it actually feel like when the ACL tears?
Yes, that popping sound, or sensation. It's one of the classic signs of an ACL tear. People often describe it as a sudden giving way feeling in the knee, like the ground shifted beneath them, and it's usually accompanied by immediate pain and swelling.
Yeah, I can only imagine that's pretty alarming. What causes that swelling?
Well, when the ACL tears, there's bleeding inside the knee joint. It's called hemarthrosis. That blood irritates the joint lining, leading to inflammation and swelling.
Oh, arthrosis. That sounds serious.
It can be. And here's the tricky part. That hemarthrosis, that blood filling up the joint, it can actually create a false sense of stability, masking the true severity of the injury.
Wait, so someone might think their knee is okay because it feels kind of stable, but actually, there's a serious injury.
Exactly. It can be deceptive. That initial feeling of stability can be misleading, which is why it's so important to get it checked out by a doctor if you think you might have torn your ACL.
So don't just tough it out. Good advice. Now, how do doctors actually diagnose an ACL tear? What kind of tests do they do?
After taking a detailed history, you know, asking about the mechanism of injury, we do a physical exam focusing on specific maneuvers designed to test the stability of the ACL.
Like what?
One of the most sensitive tests is the Lachman test, and that's pronounced L-A-C-K man, not Lachman, by the way.
Oh, good to know. I've heard it both ways. Mm-hmm. So how does the Lachman test work?
So the patient lies on their back with the knee bent at about 30 degrees. The examiner stabilizes the thigh with one hand and uses the other hand to gently pull the shin bone forward. If the ACL is torn, that shin bone will move forward excessively, and it won't feel as firm or as tight as a healthy knee.
So it's basically checking if the shin bone is too loose.
Exactly. And the Lachman test is really considered the gold standard for diagnosing ACL tears, especially in the early stages when there's a lot of swelling.
Are there other tests that they do?
Yeah. Another common one is the anterior drawer test, which is similar to the Lachman but done with the knee bent at a 90-degree angle. It's a bit easier to do, but it's not quite as accurate, especially if there's a lot of swelling.
Got it. So the Lachman is the go-to for ACL tears. You mentioned that swelling, the hemarthrosis, can make it tough to diagnose an ACL tear. Are there any other things that can make the diagnosis tricky?
Oh, definitely. Sometimes the patient's hamstring muscles might be really tense, resisting those attempts to move the shin bone, and that can lead to a false negative result. Or there might be other injuries present, like a meniscus tear or a fracture, that can cloud the picture.
So it's a bit of a puzzle sometimes putting all the pieces together.
Exactly. And sometimes we need additional imaging, like an MRI, to confirm the diagnosis or rule out other problems.
Speaking of other ligaments, what about the PCL? How are PCL injuries different from ACL injuries?
Well, PCL injuries present a bit differently for a few reasons. First, like we talked about, the mechanism of injury is usually different. Instead of twisting force, it's often a direct blow to the front of the knee, like we see in car accidents when the knee hits the dashboard.
Right. So the direction of the force is key. What about the symptoms? Are they similar to an ACL tear?
There are some similarities, but some key differences too. Patients with PCL tears definitely experience pain and swelling, but it's typically not as bad as with ACL tears. And that popping sensation we talked about earlier, it's less common with PCL tears.
Interesting. So how do they diagnose a PCL tear?
We use what's called the posterior drawer test, which is basically the opposite of the anterior drawer test. Instead of pulling the shin bone forward, we push it backward. And if PCL is torn, that shin bone's going to move backward excessively.
So it's checking for that abnormal backward movement of the shin bone. You mentioned earlier that the PCL can sometimes heal on its own. Does that mean people can live with a PCL tear and not need surgery?
In some cases, yes. If the tear is partial and the knee feels stable, we might try conservative management, like bracing and physical therapy, especially for people who aren't super active. But for folks with complete tears, active lifestyles, or significant instability, surgery is usually recommended to get that function back and prevent problems down the road.
Okay, so it depends on the individual and how bad the tear is. What can happen if a PCL tear is left untreated? Can it lead to other issues later on?
Yeah, that's a great question. It's something that often gets overlooked. Even if a PCL tear doesn't cause immediate instability, it can lead to problems over time.
Like what?
Well, since the PCL is all about preventing that shin bone from sliding too far backward, a chronic PCL deficiency can actually lead to pain in the front of the knee.
Wait, so a problem in the back of the knee can cause pain in the front. How does that work?
It's all about compensation. When that PCL is deficient, the quadriceps muscles, those big muscles in the front of your thigh, have to work overtime to compensate for the instability. They're constantly like holding onto the shin bone to prevent it from sliding back. And all that extra work can put a ton of stress on the patellofemoral joint, the joint between the kneecap and the thigh bone. And that leads to pain and even arthritis over time.
So even though PCL tears might not seem as dramatic as ACL tears, they can still cause issues long term if they're not addressed properly.
Exactly. And that's why a proper diagnosis and discussion of treatment options is so important for anyone with a suspected PCL injury.
That's a good point. Before we move on to imaging, I just want to remind our listeners about that excellent resource, Orthopedia. It's free, peer-reviewed, and available at www.orthopedia.com.
It's amazing, all that information right there at your fingertips.
Okay, so we've talked about how doctors use their hands and their knowledge to diagnose these ligament tears. But how do we actually see the damage? What role does imaging play?
Imaging is so important for confirming the diagnosis, seeing how bad the injury is, and also for looking for any other injuries that might be hiding.
So what kind of imaging do they typically use for cruciate ligament injuries?
Well, x-rays are good for ruling out fractures, but they don't really show the ligaments themselves. So the gold standard for imaging cruciate ligament tears is MRI, magnetic resonance imaging.
MRI, the go-to for ligaments. So what does an MRI actually show when someone has an ACL or PCL tear?
With an ACL tear, the MRI can show if the ligament is stretched, partially torn, or completely ruptured. We also might see what we call a kissing contusion, which are basically bone bruises on both the femur and the tibia, right where they hit each other during the injury.
Kissing contusion. That sounds painful.
Oh, it is. It's like a bruise on the bone. It happens when the force of the injury is so strong that it slams those bones together.
Ouch. What about PCL tears? Are there any specific MRI findings for that?
It's similar to ACL tears. The MRI can show us how bad the damage to the PCL is. You know, is it stretched, partially torn, completely ruptured? And we might see those bone bruises again in areas where the tibia and femur made contact during the injury.
So the MRI isn't just about looking at the ligaments. It's also about looking at the bones to see if there's any trauma.
Exactly. And here's another important thing. The MRI also helps us spot other injuries that often go hand in hand with cruciate ligament tears.
Oh, like what? What else should we be looking for?
We often see meniscus tears, collateral ligament damage, even articular cartilage injuries, all happening alongside those cruciate ligament tears. And these associated injuries can really complicate things when it comes to recovery, so it's super important to identify them early on.
So the MRI gives us a much more complete picture of what's going on inside the knee, like a roadmap for treatment and recovery. Are there any red flags on an MRI that would indicate a more serious or complex injury?
Absolutely. For instance, if someone can't fully straighten their knee after an injury, it could be a sign of a displaced meniscus tear, and that often needs more urgent attention because it can get in the way of the knee's normal movement.
Okay, that makes sense. Any other red flags to be aware of?
Another one, especially in young men, is if we see a large amount of fluid buildup in the knee. While this can be normal after a knee injury, in young men, it might actually be a sign of a gonorrhea infection.
Wow, that's definitely not something you usually think about with a sports injury. So it's important to consider all the possibilities and not jump to conclusions based on a single finding.
Exactly. It's a good reminder that diagnosis is like detective work. You know, we're gathering all the clues and piecing them together to get the full story.
Well, this has been a crash course on cruciate ligaments. We've learned about their structure, function, how they get injured, and the key differences between ACL and PCL tears. I'm definitely starting to understand why they're so important for knee stability and why injuries to them can be such a big deal.
It's a lot to take in, and really we've only scratched the surface. Remember, there's tons more information available at orthopedia.com, a free peer-reviewed resource that goes into even more detail.
Thanks for that reminder. Now, I'm curious, what happens next? Once a cruciate ligament tear is diagnosed, what are the treatment options? Is surgery always necessary?
That's a great question, and one we'll be tackling in part two of our cruciate ligament deep dive. Stay tuned to learn more about the different ways we approach treating these injuries and the things we consider when making those decisions. Welcome back to our deep dive into the world of cruciate ligaments. Last time, we talked about the anatomy of the ACL and PCL, how they can be injured, and what diagnosing those injuries looks like.
Yeah, it was really interesting to learn how these, you know, seemingly simple structures play such a huge role in keeping our knees stable. But now I'm curious about what happens next, you know, once someone is actually diagnosed with a cruciate ligament tear. What are the treatment options? And is surgery always the answer?
That's a great question. And the answer, like a lot of things in medicine, is it depends. Not every cruciate ligament tear needs surgery. The decision really comes down to a few factors, things like the severity of the tear, how active the person is, their age, and their goals.
So like a young athlete with a complete ACL tear who wants to get back to playing sports is probably going to need surgery, whereas someone who's older, has a partial tear, and is less active might be able to manage it without surgery.
Exactly. For people who are really active, especially those doing sports with lots of pivoting and cutting, surgery is often the best way to restore stability and prevent those long-term problems. But for those who aren't as active or whose symptoms aren't really impacting their daily life, non-surgical treatment can be a good option.
Okay, so it really varies from person to person. Let's start with the non-surgical approach. What does that involve?
Well, non-surgical treatment is all about protecting the knee, reducing pain and inflammation, and getting that strength and mobility back. It often starts with the good old RICE protocol. Rest, ice, compression, and elevation.
Right, the classic RICE protocol. Always a good place to start with any injury.
It is. And as that initial pain and swelling starts to go down, we'll start some gentle range of motion exercises just to prevent stiffness and help get that knee moving again. And then once it's moving a bit more freely, we move on to strengthening exercises.
What kind of strengthening exercises are we talking about?
The focus is on strengthening the muscles that support the knee, especially the quadriceps and the hamstrings. These muscles are like your dynamic stabilizers, helping to control the knee's movement and protect those ligaments.
So even without surgery, those muscles are key for providing stability.
Absolutely. Sometimes we might recommend a brace to give some extra support, especially early on in the healing process. And physical therapy is usually a big part of non-surgical treatment, guiding people through those exercises and helping them regain strength, flexibility, and function.
So it's a pretty comprehensive approach, focusing on rehab and empowering those muscles to take on some of that stabilizing work. But let's talk about the other side of things, surgery. What happens during a cruciate ligament surgery?
The goal of surgery is to reconstruct that torn ligament, basically replacing it with a new, strong structure. We do that using a graft.
A graft. Where does that come from?
There are a couple of options. One is to use a tendon from the patient's own body, which we call an autograft.
So they're basically borrowing a tendon from somewhere else to rebuild the ligament.
Exactly. Some common sources for autografts are the patellar tendon, which connects the kneecap to the shin bone, or the hamstring tendons, those strong tendons at the back of the thigh.
Are there any downsides to using your own tendon? Does it cause any problems at the donor site?
Well, it does mean creating another surgical site to harvest that tendon, and there can be some discomfort or weakness in that area initially, but the body is pretty amazing at healing, and those donor sites usually do very well. Overall, autografts have a good track record, and they're often the preferred choice for young athletes or those with higher activity demands.
What if someone doesn't want to use their own tendon, or if it's not a good option for them? Are there any alternatives?
Yeah, we can also use a tendon from a donor, which we call an allograft. Allografts come from cadavers and go through a really strict screening process to make sure they're safe.
So it's kind of like an organ transplant, but for a tendon.
That's a good way to think about it. The advantage of allografts is that we don't need to do another surgery to take the tendon. This can be a good option for older individuals, people with certain health conditions, or those who just want a less invasive procedure.
So both approaches have their pros and cons. How do surgeons decide which type of graft to use for a particular patient?
It's a decision we make together with the patient, considering their age, how active they are, their medical history, their preferences, and our own experience. For young athletes, we often favor autografts because they have a slightly lower risk of tearing again compared to allografts. But for older patients, or those who are less active, allografts can be a great choice, and they avoid those potential complications of taking a tendon from the patient's own body.
Okay, that makes sense. So once they've chosen the graft, how do they actually reconstruct the ligament? It sounds like a pretty delicate procedure.
It is delicate, but luckily surgical techniques have come a long way. Cruciate ligament reconstruction is usually done arthroscopically these days.
Arthroscopically? That sounds pretty high tech. What does that mean?
It means we use a tiny camera called an arthroscope and special instruments that we insert through small incisions around the knee. This lets us see inside the joint and do the reconstruction without disturbing the surrounding tissues too much.
So it's like a tiny surgery happening inside the knee. What do they actually do with the graft?
Basically, we create tunnels in the femur and the tibia, the bones where the original ligament was attached. Then we carefully pass the graft through these tunnels and secure it using screws or other fixation devices. The idea is to recreate the original anatomy of the ligament so it can provide that same stability and control.
It sounds like a very precise and meticulous process. What happens after the surgery? Is it a long recovery?
Recovery after cruciate ligament surgery is a gradual process, and it's different for everyone, but it usually takes several months to fully regain strength and function.
Months? Wow, it's quite a commitment. What does that recovery look like?
The early stages of rehab focus on managing pain and swelling, getting that range of motion back, and protecting that newly reconstructed ligament. We start with gentle exercises and gradually increase the intensity as the knee heals and gets stronger.
What sorts of exercises are we talking about?
At first, it's lots of simple movements, like bending and straightening the knee, and over time, it progresses to harder exercises that build strength, endurance, and that super important neuromuscular control.
Neuromuscular control. It sounds like more than just muscle strength.
You're right. It's about retraining the brain to communicate with the muscles that control the knee. Remember those mechanoreceptors we talked about, the ones that give us proprioception, that sense of where our body is in space? Well, when a ligament tears, those mechanoreceptors get damaged too, which messes up the feedback loop between the brain and muscles.
So the brain isn't getting the right signals from the knee.
Exactly. And a big part of rehab is about reestablishing those connections, teaching those muscles to fire at the right time, and getting that sense of stability back. It's kind of like rewiring the electrical circuits in the knee.
I like that analogy. It really highlights how complex this recovery process is. It's not just about fixing the ligament. It's about retraining the whole system to work together again.
That's it. And it takes time, patience, and effort. Physical therapy is key throughout this recovery, guiding people through those different stages of rehab and tailoring those exercises to their individual needs and progress.
So it's a very personalized approach, like a custom training program for the knee. After all that rehab, what are the chances of someone getting back to their old activity level, especially if they're an athlete?
The good news is that the outcomes for cruciate ligament surgery are generally really good. With the right surgical technique, a good rehab program, and a motivated patient, many people, even those who play at a high level, can get back to doing what they love.
That's great to hear. But I imagine there are some long-term things to consider as well. Even with a successful surgery, is it realistic to expect the knee to be completely back to normal?
That's a really important point, and it's something we always talk about with our patients. Even the best reconstruction isn't quite as good as the original ligament. And remember those other injuries we talked about, the meniscus tears or cartilage damage. Those can affect things long term as well.
So it's not just about the ligament itself. It's about the overall health of the knee joint.
Exactly. And even with a successful surgery, there's always a chance of developing arthritis in the knee later on, especially if there was a lot of cartilage damage at the time of the injury.
So even with a great surgery and rehab, it's not a guaranteed happy ending for the knee.
Unfortunately, no. But that doesn't mean people can't live full and active lives after cruciate ligament surgery. It just means we need to be aware of those potential long-term effects and do what we can to protect our knees, especially as we get older.
That's a good reminder for all of us, injury or not. Before we move on, I just want to quickly remind our listeners about that great resource you mentioned, Orthopedia. It's available online for free at www.orthopedia.com, and it has tons of information about cruciate ligaments and all sorts of other orthopedic topics.
It really is a fantastic resource. Can't recommend it enough.
Okay, so we've talked about non-surgical and surgical treatment for cruciate ligament tears.
Right.
Let's switch gears a bit and talk about prevention. Are there things people can do to lower their chances of getting these injuries in the first place?
Oh, absolutely. A lot of it comes back to those muscles we were talking about, the quads and hamstrings. Strong, well-conditioned muscles act like shock absorbers and dynamic stabilizers, helping to manage all those forces that go through the knee and protect those ligaments.
So hitting the gym can actually help protect our knees.
You got it. And it's not just about building huge muscles. Neuromuscular control, that ability to coordinate and control those muscles precisely, is just as important.
So what kinds of exercises should we be doing?
We want exercises that really challenge balance, coordination, and agility. Things like plyometrics, single leg squats, agility drills, they help train those mechanoreceptors and improve that connection between the brain and muscles, making the knee more resilient to those sudden movements that can lead to injury.
It's really interesting how much emphasis there is on training the nervous system, not just the muscles themselves.
It's crucial. We often say it's not just about making muscles bigger, it's about making them smarter.
I love that. Making muscles smarter. I got to spiel that one.
Yeah.
Are there any specific sports or activities that are more likely to cause cruciate ligament injuries?
Sports that involve a lot of pivoting, cutting, and jumping, like basketball, soccer, and skiing, definitely have higher rates of ACL tears. But even things like tennis and volleyball, with all those quick changes in direction, can put a lot of stress on those ligaments.
So it's not just the sport, it's how you play it, too.
Exactly. Good technique is key. Landing softly after jumps, using the right form when changing direction, avoiding those sudden jerky movements can all help prevent those injuries.
It's like those safety tips they always show on the ski slopes. Slow down, stay in control, and know your limits.
Exactly. And just like with skiing, fatigue plays a big role. When your muscles are tired, they're not as good at supporting and stabilizing the knee, which makes you much more likely to twist or turn the wrong way. So pacing yourself, taking breaks, and listening to your body is so important for injury prevention.
So it's a multi-pronged approach. Building strength, improving neuromuscular control, using proper technique, and avoiding fatigue.
That's right. It's all about taking a holistic approach to protecting those important ligaments. And remember, this is just the tip of the iceberg. To learn more, I encourage everyone to visit www.orthopedia.com and see all the amazing information they have.
Great advice. Now, I'm curious, what else is there to learn about these things? Are there any mysteries left to solve or any exciting new research happening in the world of cruciate ligaments?
There's always more to discover. And that's what we're going to be talking about in part 3 of our cruciate ligament deep dive. We'll look at some of the most interesting questions, discuss the latest research, and maybe even challenge some of the traditional thinking about these crucial knee stabilizers.
Welcome back to the deep dive. We've been on this fascinating journey through the world of cruciate ligaments, you know, those super important but often overlooked structures that keep our knees working properly.
It's been quite the adventure, hasn't it? We've talked about their anatomy, how they can get injured, how we diagnose those injuries, and all the different treatment options.
Yeah, we've really gotten deep into the details of these ligaments, but you mentioned there's even more to uncover, like some really intriguing questions and some cutting-edge research that could change how we think about cruciate ligaments. So tell me more. What else is there?
Well, let's go back to those amazing mechanoreceptors we've been talking about. You know, they're like tiny sensors inside the ligaments, always sending information to the brain about where the knee is and how it's moving. But here's a really fascinating part. They're not just passively sending messages. They actually play an active role in protecting the ligaments from injury.
Wait, really? How do they do that? I thought they were just, you know, sending signals to the brain.
They do send signals, but those signals can trigger incredibly fast reflexes. So when those mechanoreceptors sense a sudden stretch or strain on the ligament, boom, they send a signal to the spinal cord, which triggers an immediate reflex, causing the muscles around the knee to contract. It's like a built-in safety mechanism, slamming on the brakes before that ligament gets overstretched or torn.
Wow, so it's like a preemptive strike against injury.
Yeah.
Our bodies are amazing, working so hard to protect us without us even realizing it.
Exactly, and this really underscores the importance of that neuromuscular training we were talking about earlier. When we strengthen those muscles and improve that brain-muscle connection, we're basically fine-tuning those protective reflexes, making the knee that much more resilient and less likely to give way.
It just blows my mind how interconnected everything is. You know, the nervous system, the muscles, the ligaments, all working together to keep us moving.
I know, right? It's pretty incredible. And that interconnectedness brings me to another really interesting question. What if we've been wrong all along about the ACL's limited healing potential?
Hold on. Are you suggesting that the ACL might actually be able to heal itself? I thought once it was torn, that was it, surgery or nothing.
Yeah, that's been the traditional thinking for a long time. But there's some exciting new research suggesting that the ACL might actually have some regenerative capacity after all. We're starting to think that maybe we've underestimated its healing power.
That would be huge. So what's making researchers think that the ACL might be able to heal on its own?
Well, one theory is that the synovial fluid, you know, the fluid that lubricates the knee joint, might actually be getting in the way of the healing process. It's thought that the synovial fluid, while great for lubrication, might actually be washing away that blood clot that forms after an ACL tear. And that blood clot is really important because it creates a scaffold that's necessary for new tissue growth.
So it's like the synovial fluid is a little too good at its job, accidentally removing those building blocks for healing.
Exactly. And then there's another factor that we're starting to question: immobilization. Traditionally, after an ACL tear, we've kept the knee still to protect those healing tissues. But what if all that lack of movement is actually preventing the ligament from healing the way it should?
So maybe instead of resting the knee, we actually need to encourage some movement to help it heal.
That's the idea. Some researchers believe that controlled movement, started early in the recovery process, might actually stimulate healing by increasing blood flow to the area and promoting the formation of new collagen fibers. You know, those tough, rope-like fibers that give ligaments their strength.
It's like that old saying, use it or lose it, might actually apply to ligaments too.
Yeah.
It's wild to think that our traditional approach to ACL tears that rest in immobilization might actually be doing more harm than good.
It's definitely a shift in thinking, and it's opening up some really exciting new possibilities for research and treatment. Just imagine a future where we could use the body's own healing abilities to repair torn ACLs, no grafts, no major surgery.
Now that would be a game changer in the world of sports medicine. I can already see the headlines, ACL tears, no longer a career ender. But I'm guessing there's still a lot of research to be done before we get to that point.
Oh, absolutely. This research is still in its early stages, but it's super promising. It could really change how we approach ACL tears in the years to come.
It's exciting to think about what the future holds. Now, before we wrap up, I wanted to touch on something that's been talked about a lot lately. The differences between men and women when it comes to cruciate ligament injuries. I've heard that women are more likely to tear their ACLs than men. Is there any truth to that?
Yeah, it's definitely not a myth. Studies have shown time and time again that female athletes, especially those in high-impact sports like soccer, basketball, and volleyball, have a much higher risk of ACL tears compared to male athletes.
That's concerning. Is it just bad luck, or is there more to it than that?
It's definitely more than just bad luck. Researchers think there are several factors at play. Some studies suggest that women might have some anatomical differences in their knee joints that make them more susceptible.
Like what kinds of differences?
Well, for example, women tend to have a wider pelvis and a narrower intercondylar notch, which is that space between the bony bumps at the end of the femur. These structural differences can affect how the knee moves, and that can potentially put more stress on the ACL, making it more vulnerable to injury.
So the actual structure of the knee itself could be playing a role. Are there any other possible explanations?
Yeah, those hormonal fluctuations throughout the menstrual cycle have also been linked to ACL injury risk. Studies have shown that women might be more likely to tear their ACLs during certain phases of their cycle, especially when estrogen levels are high. The thinking is that estrogen might change the properties of the ligaments, making them a bit more relaxed and therefore more prone to injury.
That's really interesting. So it's like this whole hormonal dance that's going on, and it can actually affect how stable our knees are.
Exactly. And we're just starting to understand how hormones affect ligament health. It's a complex area.
What about muscle strength and neuromuscular control? Could those things play a role in this gender difference in ACL tears?
Definitely. On average, women tend to rely more on their quadriceps muscles for knee stability, while men use their hamstrings more. And as we talked about earlier, those hamstrings are really important for protecting the ACL, acting like a dynamic brake to stop that shin bone from sliding forward too much.
Right. So if women are relying more on their quads and less on their hamstrings, that could explain why they're more likely to tear their ACLs.
Exactly. It's a difference in how the muscles work that might be contributing to that increased risk. And this really emphasizes how important it is for female athletes to have targeted strengthening programs that focus on those crucial hamstring muscles.
It sounds like there's still a lot to learn about these gender differences and how we can do a better job of protecting female athletes.
There is. But the good news is that researchers are really digging into these issues, and we're learning more all the time about what's going on. Hopefully, this knowledge will lead to better ways to prevent these injuries and more personalized treatment approaches for female athletes in the future.
Well, this has been an incredible journey into the world of cruciate ligaments. We've gone from the basics to the cutting edge, and it's clear that these ligaments are way more complex and interesting than most people realize.
It really has been a deep dive. I hope everyone listening has a newfound appreciation for the vital role these ligaments play, and also a sense of wonder about all the research that's happening and how it's constantly changing our understanding.
I know I do.
Yeah.
And speaking of expanding our understanding, I want to remind everyone about that awesome resource you've mentioned, Orthopedia. It's free, it's peer-reviewed, and it's available online at www.orthopedia.com. If you want to learn more about cruciate ligaments or any other orthopedic topic for that matter, I highly recommend checking it out.
It's a phenomenal resource, truly a gift to anyone who wants to learn more about the musculoskeletal system.
Couldn't agree more. And to all our listeners, thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive into the world of cruciate ligaments. We hope you found it informative, engaging, and maybe even a little inspiring. Until next time, stay curious, keep learning, and take good care of those knees.